uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from California to Pennsylvania, streaming down and from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, beaming around the planet on RadioPower.org, podcast, and live on WhiteRoseSociety.org and Apple iTunes. Welcome to our program. The Iraq War continues. The Iraq War brought to you by none other than George W. Bush. He lied us into it and is continuing to try and lie his way through it. One of the things that allowed him to continue this disastrous policy was getting reelected in 2004, or I would say elected. He obviously wasn't elected the first time. In fact, when the New York Times actually counted and the consortium of news agencies actually counted the vote, they discovered that Al Gore actually won Florida by any measure. Yes, it was in the New York Times, those of you who weren't paying attention, and in the Washington Post. But nonetheless, so he wanted to get elected the second time. And now there are a lot of folks, and I've been saying this from virtually day one, and I think it's a tragedy that John Kerry hasn't been, although his wife was outspoken about it. But I think that George Bush didn't win this election either, and there's an increasing number of people concerned about that, whether he won it or not. Let's say for a moment, rhetorically, even that he did win it. Did he win it fair and square, the way that we think that you're supposed to win elections in America? Mark Crispin Miller is in a unique position to know about this. Mark is a professor of communications at New York University, the author of a number of books, including Cruel and Unusual, the most recent book about George W. Bush, and also runs markcrispinmiller.org. It's O-R-G, Mark?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or com, either one.
Or com. Good. That's wise to grab both of them.
Mark?
MarkCrispinMiller.org or MarkCrispinMiller.com, his blog. And Mark is one of the one of my favorite people, one of the regular sources for material that you hear on this program. Mark is just kind of at the center of everything that's going on in the progressive community, and I'm really pleased and honored to have you with me, Mark.
Well, I'm pleased and honored to be on your show, Tom, because it's reciprocated.
Well, thank you. You are tracking down something that I was talking about, and I think I'm the only guy that was talking about this during the election. In the weeks leading up to the election, I was just pounding this thing, and I couldn't get anybody to pay attention to it, and that was that there was... And perhaps it was, well, I'm not sure why nobody was noticing it, but in Las Vegas, there was actual video footage of this. There was a company that was, and they came, and then they closed up shop there when they got caught, and they came to Oregon, and they got caught here. There was and it was portrayed as like a little merry band of pranksters, you know, maybe a half a dozen people who would set up tables outside shopping malls or government buildings and say, you know, with signs that say, do you want to register to vote? Register here. And it was a legitimate, you know, voting registration forms, and people would register to vote. And it says on there, do you want to vote in the Republican primary, the Democratic primary, or neither of the above, independent? You know, what's your affiliation? And it turns out that if people said Democratic, then they tore them up and threw them away. And then there was this other scam that was going on here in Oregon where they were showing up with clipboards and saying, you know, the medical marijuana initiative, which we have here in Oregon, is under assault. And do you want to maintain this? And in other states, it was, you know, do you want to decriminalize marijuana, or, you know, do you want to have medical marijuana, or do you think gays should be allowed to marry? Questions that, by and large, Democrats would be more likely to agree with than Republicans, the so-called wedge issues. And they'd say, just sign this, and they'd give them a clipboard where the top half of the page was either folded over or was covered by the clip on the clipboard, and just say, here, just sign at the bottom, and, you know, fill in the thing with your name and your address and your social or whatever it is, and then sign at the bottom. And people would sign this thinking they were signing a petition, when in fact they were changing their voting registration either from Democrat to Republican, or more insidiously, they were changing their voter registration from one county to another, so that when they showed up at the polls, or one precinct to another, so when they showed up at the polls, waited 6 hours in line, finally get up to vote, they're told, I'm sorry, you can't vote here, you've got to go someplace else. At that point, they throw their hands up in the air and go away. And this was played as just little local stories. And you've discovered something about these guys.
Yeah, Sproul and Associates is its name. The founder, Nathan Sproul, was one time the head of the Arizona Christian Coalition, and then was head of the Arizona Republican Party. So he's up to his eyeballs in the, you know, Christianist wing of the Republican Party. His company was hired directly by the Republican National Committee to work nationally, basically to preempt as many Democratic votes as possible. You've laid it out quite well. In some cases, they actually asked people to register as Republicans. These would be young students, kind of gullible students, you know, said, well, you want to save the whales, don't you? Well, it's just a technicality. It's more, the petition is more likely to work to save the whales or to, you know, save medical marijuana if you just become a Republican for a week, and then it'll automatically revert to your other party. It was completely illegal. It was fraudulent. It involved copyright infringement because they used the name of an actually legitimate organization.
You mean they would represent themselves as being like Greenpeace or something?
America Votes, I believe, is the name of the organization, which threatened to sue them if they stopped referring to themselves as America Votes. They were supposed to be nonpartisan. You know, in Oregon, for example, all over Oregon, they were allowed to operate front of libraries until some librarians got, you know, justly suspicious. They looked into these people's actions, and they turned out to be a cadre of operatives hired by the Republican National Committee. And what I've discovered, and it's on my website, is that the Republican National Committee paid considerably more money to Sproul and Associates than has been publicly revealed.
So this wasn't just a local group of zealots, and it wasn't even a local group really at all. This was a national campaign that was coming from the top down, from former Enron lobbyist Ed Gillespie and former Enron and Bin Laden family recipient of largesse George W. Bush, to, on a national level, tinker with our election apparatus.
Well, what other conclusion can we draw from the fact that the Republican National Committee paid Sproul and Associates not like $3 million or $4 million, which some reports suggested early on, but paid them $8.3 million for their activities last fall. Many of the monies, you know, much of that money was actually concealed from view through tricky paperwork. You know, the stuff's all online. I'm talking about the RNC's report to the Federal Election Commission. You know, there'll be a sum of like $1.5 million for lodging and transportation September 2005. You know, ways to...
Which has not yet arrived.
It hadn't yet arrived, yeah. So they got a lot of money for lodging and transportation this September.
In the future.
In the future.
Yes.
It's very... Now, I think this relates to the huge scandal in Ohio these days, which no media outside of Ohio is covering, so-called CoinGate scandal, because that involves big-time money laundering for the party. And I think that the millions spent on Sproul's illegal, anti-democratic, small-d activities is probably a dangerous money as far as the Republicans are concerned, because we don't know where it came from. You know?
Interesting.
Let me add, just for the sake of broadening the base of people who are in the know, that I've got an article, an excerpt from my new book, will be coming out in the next issue of Harper's Magazine. That's the August issue. The cover story is called None Dare Call It Stolen, and it's primarily about the Conyers Report and how that was ignored by the press and so on.
Right.
My book on the election, in which I argue that it was stolen. There is no evidence. There is really, other than the official figures, there is no evidence to speak of that Bush won. But there is abundant evidence that they suppressed a lot of votes. Anyway,
well, and we've got exit polls that indicate that he lost.
Well,
apropos of Ohio, Mark, we're talking with Mark Crispin Miller. MarkCrispinMiller.org, his blog and his website for more information on him and his work and his books. John in Cuyahoga Falls, Ohio, is one of our callers, is calling specifically about this topic. If you don't mind, we pick up
sure.
a call here. John, you're live and on the air with Mark Crispin Miller.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, living on Ohio these days, it's enough to boil your blood. right now, our Secretary of State, the guy who monitors elections and so-called grades and checks the petitions that come in for ballot initiatives, is sponsoring two initiatives of his own. Oh, by the way, he's running for governor, too.
Right.
One is campaign finance reform that's specifically targeting unions and doesn't say anything about the billions of dollars that comes in from corporations. And the other one is not raising taxes over unless there's a statewide vote, you know, not even caring about what inflation does. But the point is, he's got this outside firm from Michigan that they're paying per signature to come in, and what they do, and the reason I know this is because I'm working on another ballot initiative to fix our school funding here in Ohio, and they have two-sided clipboards. They say, hey, do you want your taxes not to go up unless you vote? Well, yeah. And they say, well, then sign this. And then they flip it over and they say, to confirm your signature, sign this here.
Oh, man.
And it's
unbelievable.
And I saw all day last Tuesday, we had a special election in Euclid, Ohio. I saw that representative do that all day. And you know, it's despicable. And where are those ballots going? They're going to Ken Blackwell's office to be checked and make sure they're valid when he's the guy that's sponsoring the two initiatives.
Incredible.
It's criminal.
So it's still going on. It's still going on. And John, thanks for that call. Dave in Humboldt County, California on the line for Mark Crispin Miller. Hey, Dave.
Gentlemen, Mark, what's concerned me for the longest time, above everything else in voter fraud, is the use of these corporate voting machines that leave no record and that can be easily altered.
Yeah, yeah.
Is there any chance that we can override the efforts of a few people in the House and the Senate to block every effort to make these machines verifiable?
Good question, Dave. We only have about a minute left
here. Okay, he's in California, right?
Yeah.
All right, well, California had a Secretary of State till very recently who was dead set against allowing paperless machines.
Yeah, Arnold got rid of him in a hurry.
They got rid of him in a hurry, and now those machines are coming back. They want to put them in New York. They want to put them in Maryland. I'm much more of a purist on this matter. I don't think machines with paper receipts are good enough. I think that any computerized system is too vulnerable, too insecure to be used in a serious democracy. I think what we have to have are paper ballots. There is one kind of machine that actually allows you to fill out a paper ballot, TrueVote. The guy who found it was mysteriously killed in a big car accident a few months ago. Well, but I'm not going to get into that.
Yeah.
At any rate, we need paper ballots.
Right,
nothing
because otherwise it's violating the whole idea that our vote should be handled in a transparent fashion because you
exactly
can't see
right.
inside a computer.
That's exactly right. This is a crucial issue. The whole point of all this research, you know, is God knows, is not to put John Kerry in the White House. The purpose of it is to spark genuine, radical electoral reform. It's got to happen as soon as possible.
There you go. Well said. From your lips to God's ears, Mark. Mark Crispin Miller with us. MarkCrispinMiller.org, his website. Check it out. Mark, thanks for being on the program and for your great work.
Well, thank you, Tom.
It's 20 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program. The
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Hey, everybody, let's have some fun. You only live but once, and when you're dead, you're done. So let the good time roll.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you in the second hour of our program, by the way. Dick Patton's going to be with us, a conservative who's going to tell us why... Or he's going to try to tell us. We'll see how far he gets. He's going to try and tell us why the so-called death tax should be ended. And billionaires and multi-millionaires should be allowed to pass along all of their wealth to future generations so that dynasties can emerge in America. And we can go back to the way it was in jolly old England in the 1700s. We thought that we had left that behind. In the third hour of our program, Larry Tye is going to be with us. He's the author of a new book, Rising from the Rails, Pullman Porters and the Making of the Black Middle Class. And it's actually a fascinating book. The first 15 minutes or so of each hour, we'll be talking to those folks. And then, of course, we'll get into your calls and more rants and general news. And one of our terrorists is going to be sentenced today. Yes, a major domestic terrorist, one of the terrorists who actually killed people in the United States, major acts of terror, major bombings. Eric Rudolph is going to be sentenced in the United States today. He avoided the death penalty by confessing to the Alabama blast and the bombing in the 1996 Olympics, and injured over 100 people, killed one woman. Also admitted setting off bombs at an abortion clinic and a gay bar in Atlanta in 97. I lived in Atlanta when this happened, and I'll tell you, this guy really did terrorize that city. And why he is not being referred to in the media as a terrorist, particularly by the Reich wingers, who got all upset when the BBC referred to the London bombers as bombers and not terrorists, is beyond me. I just don't get it. I'm, you know, not trying to be the language police here, but I just don't get it. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. And Matt in Danville listening. Danville, California, Matt?
Danville, Kansas.
Kansas. Oh, I'm sorry.
Population 92.
Oh, my goodness. That's great.
Tom, a real quick question. I'll hang up and listen to your comments. But on this voting, most places that I am aware of, if you vote absentee, you vote on a paper ballot, and that ballot is recorded. I'm wondering if a good way for us to go to make sure our votes are counted is for everybody to vote absentee.
No, it's not. And here's why. Here in Oregon, for example, we have 100% vote by mail. And which is all paper ballots. And it's a marvelous system because it has produced some of the highest rates of voter participation in the United States, just incredibly high. The problem is that when you submit an absentee ballot or a vote-by-mail ballot, you're filling in the little circles, you know, like on the tests we took in high school, the SATs
yeah.
and whatnot, and those are read by scanners. And those scanners are hooked up to computers. And those computers are, in some cases, available to hackers. And those computers and those scanners are manufactured by ES&S and Diebold and other voting machine companies. So even though you voted on paper, your machine is actually counted by the machines of the very companies that we're all so concerned about.
Same problem.
Yeah. And now there's two solutions to this. The solution that's kind of the more general solution is, why don't we just say in every state in the union, just mandate by federal law, if, you know, number one, that it has to be done the way you and I are talking about, that is, at least there's a paper trail, even if it's counted by a machine, and that say 3% or 5% of them are randomly hand counted, not just audited, but hand counted. And if that hand count, the percentage of votes in the hand count differs from the percentage of votes in the machine count, that triggers an automatic recount of everything. Because, for example, in Washington State, and there's a lawsuit going on in Snohomish County, Washington State, about this. In Washington State, the people who voted by mail, the absentee ballots, the people who showed up and filled out a ballot, the majority of them voted for the Democrat for governor, but the electronic voting machine said that the Republican, Dino Rossi, actually won. And so, you know, it's like, how can it be that the only difference is the technology? I mean, they've figured all other variables. So that's number one. My point is, what do we have private corporations handling our vote for in the first place? There should not be private for-profit corporations claiming trade secrecy as the basis for not telling us how they're handling our vote and how their software is written handling our vote in private and in secret. It's wrong. It's just absolutely wrong. Thanks a lot for the call, Matt. Good to hear from you. And, you know, this is just, it should not be happening in the United States that we've got private corporations handling our vote in secret and then telling us how we voted. It's just wrong. 29 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Working 9 to 5, what a way to make a living. Barely getting by, it's all taking and no giving.
And welcome back, my friends. Yeah, if the cons have their way, you'll be working not just 9 to 5, 9 to 6, 9 to 7, 9 to 8, 9 to 9, 9 to 10. No minimum wage laws, no worker protections. They've already done away with overtime. What's next? Well, I can tell you what's next on their list. They want to do away with minimum wage laws. They want to do away with Social Security. They want to privatize it. Eventually, they'll want to do away with Medicare because it represents a threat to the private medical insurance companies. On and on. It's called rolling back the New Deal. It's called getting rid of all the reforms that Roosevelt brought into place. I mean, it's not like it's a secret. They're just out there doing it. You know, just saying, hey, you know, Roosevelt's dead and you know, his legacy lives on, but we're, well, here. As the great Bimbo himself says,
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
And, I, you know, it's just amazing to me that average Americans can listen to that and think, oh, yeah, those conservatives, they represent me. It's a, no, I don't think so. Sorry, don't think so at all. Interesting, this, in the Taiwan Straits newspaper, it's the Taipei Times, excuse me, the Taipei Times, why this isn't the screaming headline across the United States. You'll recall last week I shared with you the fact that China, that a Chinese general said that if we so much as locked our weapons systems onto the Chinese missiles that are pointed at Taiwan, that they would launch nuclear missiles and take out, quoting this Chinese general, hundreds of American cities with nuclear weapons. We have now been threatened, officially threatened, by China with nuclear weapons. Where are the hysterics? Where is even a discussion of this? Why is this not being discussed in the evening news? Why isn't this in the major newspapers in the United States? The Agence France-Presse, right? The British, the European press, the French press. Dateline Beijing yesterday. And I quote, China refused yesterday to retract statements made by one of its generals that it would use nuclear weapons against American cities if the U.S. military intervened in the People's Liberation Army attempts to invade Taiwan. The comments came amid a flurry of criticism from Washington and Taipei on Friday. Chinese foreign ministry spokesman said, quote, we will never tolerate Taiwan independence, neither will we allow anybody to separate Thailand from the motherland. If the Americans draw their missiles and position-guided ammunition on the target zone on Taiwan's, on China's territory. Now, keep in mind, they're saying if we point at them, not if we shoot at them, if we point at them. Quote, I think we will have to respond with nuclear weapons. If the Americans are determined to interfere, then we will be determined to respond. My statement is clear. How you interpret it is up to you. End of quote. This is from Mr. Zhu, an official spokesperson for the Chinese government. Now, in the meantime, the Prime Minister of China was visited, and some Chinese businessmen were visited last year by Ralph Klein, who's the premier of the state of Alberta, one of the provinces, the province of Alberta, one of the provinces of Canada. One of the places that Alberta is one of the more oil-rich parts of Canada. They not only have just plain old good old-fashioned oil wells there, but they also have so much oil locked up in sand, what they call tar sands or oil sands, that it's the second largest supply of oil on the world, in the world, behind Saudi Arabia. Which raises the question, how long will it be before Dick Cheney decides that Canada's harboring terrorists and may have nuclear aspirations and needs to be taken out? But that's a whole other rant. In any case, Ralph Klein, the premier of Alberta, was touring China, and he just offhandedly made a comment to the business leaders of China, hey, you ought to come over and look at our oil sand deposits. This is pretty incredible. This, again, this from the Taipei Times. I mean, why isn't this the New York Times? But when Klein returned home a week later, Chinese executives were already making the rounds in Alberta, where the oil sands region is roughly the size of Florida and is believed to contain the largest reserves after Saudi Arabia. The executives' quick response paid off. Three of China's state-owned oil firms have since poured huge investments into the oil sands, including a 40% stake in a $3.6 billion project that will be able to send oil via a new pipeline to Canada's west coast for shipment where? To China! Scenes like this are being repeated around the world. Dangling cash and access to its huge market, China is dispatching legions of diplomats, surveyors, and engineers across the globe to help quench the Middle Kingdom's insatiable thirst for energy. During the last 2 years, President Hu Jintao and President Wen Jiabao have taken oil executives on trips to oil-rich countries from Algeria to Uzbekistan to seal major deals. The government in Beijing has welcomed top officials from 11 members of the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. A major point of a trip Hu made to Moscow this month was to secure access to Russia's vast reserves. Chinese crews are building roads in Africa in exchange for the right to extract oil from remote regions. Viewers in Saudi Arabia, a nation that U.S. oil firms once had to themselves, now watch Chinese programs on TV as China drills into Saudi sands. China is also taking advantage of tensions between the Bush administration and Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez to wrest oil from one of the largest U.S. suppliers. That would be Venezuela. My recollection is we're importing about 7% of our oil from Venezuela. To secure deals worth tens of billions of dollars, notes the Taipei Times, Beijing is cozying up to regimes and nations, including Iran and Sudan, that Washington labels pariahs, and it is flexing its military muscle to lay claim to contested fields in East Asia. Now, what does the Bush administration say about all this? The fact that the treasonous, traitorous American companies are shutting down factories in the United States, moving their technology over to China, setting up shop in China simply so that they can make more profit, not necessarily to lower the prices in America. I haven't noticed that the price on tennis shoes has gone down dramatically since I was a kid. When I was a kid 30, 40 years ago, I remember you could go into a store and buy a pair of tennis shoes for $5. Now it's $105. Back when I bought them, they were made in New Jersey. Now they're made in Malaysia or Taiwan or China. So why aren't they cheaper? Well, they're not cheaper because Phil Knight, among others, has become worth $7.8 billion. The Walton family, $8 billion in profit last year. It's not about low prices. The cons keep wanting to say, oh, it's about low prices, low prices, low prices. It's not about low prices. It's about profit for those at the top. And they are selling our national security down the tube. We can't even supply our own military any longer without parts from China. What's going to happen if China actually decides to threaten us? Well, they just did threaten us. What happens if China decides to take us on? We're lost. We've been sold out. And the people who sold us out are named Ronald Reagan, George Herbert Walker Bush, Bill Clinton, and George W. Bush. Ross Perot was right. And here I am, a progressive, and Ross Perot called himself a conservative, but on the trade issue, he was right. And these guys, these corporatists, it's all about, if you know, forget national sovereignty, forget what's best for America, it's all about what's best for multinational corporations. And China has been using that. You know, they're taking that old quote from good old Vladimir Lenin. The definition of a capitalist is the man who will sell you the rope to hang himself, that you're going to use to hang him with. And we have been giving China the money that they're going to use, that they are using, to threaten us militarily. Our toll-free number, 1-866-889-8894, all across the United States. If you want to drop into our chat room and learn the real secrets, you go to TomHartmann.com and click live chat. Phil in Tampa, Florida on the line. Hey, Phil, what's up?
Hi, how you doing? Listen, you know, dovetailing on what you're speaking of, you know, the Congress rejected a law that would give Bush the ability, legal authority, shall we say, an ability to scotch the deal of China's oil company buying an American oil company whose name escapes me right now.
Unocal.
Yeah, they're pretty much passive about that. They don't much care. What if the Chinese...
Well, let me just toss in maybe one of the reasons why is because the lobbying firm that the Chinese have hired to do the Unocal deal is a bunch of former George W. Bush best friends and buddies.
Sure. But my question to you is this. What if another quasi-private company in China decided, who had billions of dollars, decided they were going to go on to the U.S. stock market and buy News Corp?
I doubt that there's enough of News Corp publicly available that they could get control and interest of it. I may be wrong, but let's say hypothetically, owns a big chunk of it.
Right. Let's say hypothetically it was.
See, they don't have to. Rupert Murdoch puts, you know, Star TV, satellite TV over China, and the Chinese are using it. And the deal that he cut with them is that they can censor the content, and they're doing it. They're doing it. Rupert Murdoch cut a deal with them.
I think the White House and the Republican Congress would be more upset about News Corp being owned by the Chinese, especially if they started firing some of the key people who take their orders from the White House.
Yeah, but it ain't going to happen. So it's, you know, it's an interesting hypothetical, Phil, but it's not going to happen. But the bigger issue is, if you want to talk about, I mean, this is what gets me about people who are lovers of Fox News and Rupert Murdoch. Rupert Murdoch owns Fox Television, which runs the raunchiest stuff on TV.
Right.
Then the Fox News guys get on and they bloviate about it. Oh, can you believe Desperate Housewives or whatever the shows are? You know, I can't believe what they're doing on The Simpsons. And then on top of that, he owns Star TV in China, where he cut a deal with the communist tyrants, the communist dictators of China, and said that they could censor the news that goes down to all the Chinese people. And so Rupert Murdoch is helping the communist Chinese censor the news that gets to their people. And this is now the guy who bought the Times of London as well. I mean, you know, what's wrong with this picture? Phil, thanks for the call. It's good to hear from you. Good point that you make. And it's we'll see. I don't think that the Chinese are going to do anything that irritates us just for the sake of irritating us. I do think, though, that they have reached the point where they don't give a damn. They are buying so much of our debt right now. They're sitting on nearly $1 trillion of U.S. debt, over $800 billion of U.S. debt. That's an amount of debt that, by the way, the only way that they could acquire it is because of the insane economic policy started by Ronald Reagan. They're sitting on so much of our American debt, and continued by George Bush Sr., and now just, you know, really kicked into high gear by George Bush Jr. The only president to fight that current was Bill Clinton, to his credit, who actually balanced the budget of the United States and actually shrank the size of government. The only one of the last four presidents to do so. In any case, what just boggles my mind is that the Chinese are holding so much of our debt that if tomorrow they started saying, you know, we're not going to buy the debt anymore, we're not going to buy your debt anymore. In fact, we're going to start selling it. We're going to start dumping it on the open market. Our interest rates would go to 20-25% overnight. Our economy would go in the toilet, and they would have won. I mean, you know, consider, during World War II, we bombed German cities. Now, the reason why we bombed those German cities and killed tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of civilians, the reason that we bombed those cities was not because we wanted to kill civilians. We bombed those cities because we wanted to destroy Germany's industrial infrastructure. We wanted to blow up their factories. We wanted to blow up their streets. We wanted to blow up their ability for people to make it their way to the factories. We wanted to shut down their ability to make the materials of war so that they could no longer manufacture tanks. They could no longer manufacture uniforms. They could no longer manufacture missiles. That they could no longer manufacture planes. And by taking out their industrial infrastructure, our belief was we would make the war shorter. We would make it more difficult for them to fight a war. Guess what? The Walton family has taken out our industrial infrastructure, and they've done it on behalf of the Chinese. Or you could flip it around and say the Chinese have taken out our industrial infrastructure, and they've done it with the help of the Republicans and the Walton family. And not just the Walton family, by the way. You walk into any store and it's all made out of China. It's all made in China. The Chinese don't need to bomb our cities to destroy our industrial infrastructure. They bought it. They own it. I mean, this is a huge scandal. Speaking of scandals, what's going on in Ohio now with CoinGate? Nick in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, has some thoughts on that. Hey, Nick, what's up?
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. What's up?
The CoinGate thing, I haven't heard it, but does the name Thomas Know ring a bell in association with that CoinGate?
Yeah, isn't he the guy who was holding on to the coins?
He was the guy that was holding the coins, but about a month ago in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, about on two different days, on one day they had a small article where he had contributed $2,000 to the Bush campaign,
sure,
and Bush had turned around and said he would return that $2,000. But the other side, another day or two later, which no one has said anything about yet, and Bush has said he will not return it, was he also contributed $100,000 to the Bush campaigns. So there's a link there, too, and there's probably still more. You know, it just keeps on turning up.
Yeah, it's like Bush taking, you know, $10,000 from Mary Carey and her business manager so that the porn star could come meet the president, you know, hang out with the, you know, and these guys got all upset because Al Gore gave a speech in a Buddhist monastery.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, oh, those Buddhists, they're not Christians.
there's quite a bit wrong with the picture. But that $100,000 thing, you know, just smacks of the hypocrisy of this guy and the, again, the dishonesty of these people. You know, I mean, if you're going to return the $2,000, well, what about this under other $100,000?
Yeah. Now, we are dealing with the most corrupt administration in the history of the United States. The Reagan administration had more senior officials convicted and sent to prison than any administration in the history of America. We haven't gotten the convictions. We haven't gotten imprisonments because we have a Democrat. We have Republican-controlled House, Senate, and judiciary now. But this is, you know, without, you know, so we don't have the objective measurement that we had where we could say the Reagan administration was historically the most corrupt administration. But I'm telling you, you look at what they're doing. You look at their behavior, Nick. And thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. They are these guys, this is the most corrupt administration in the history of the United States, bar none. And we got to do something about it in 2006 at the polls. It's 10 minutes before the hour. I'm Tom Harpin.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
All that you touch and all that you see, all that you taste, all you feel, and all that you love, and all that you hate.
And I don't know. We're going to find out the senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration. And there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
At the end of the day, it's of keen interest to me to see whether or not we can get Karl Rove frog marched out of the White House in handcuffs.
And welcome back, my friends. 4 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman with you. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, Rich in Chicago on the line. Hey, Rich, what's up?
Hey, how you doing? Oh, sorry, Tom. Anyway, hey, I had lunch with a friend of mine. He was an Air Force guy, just got out of the military. His wife is still in there. And he was telling me that there's not enough good news coming from Iraq, you know? And I
maybe that's because there's not enough good news in Iraq.
That's what I said to him. But I said something very interesting to him. I said, well, you know, who attacked us on 9/11? And he actually said the right answer to me. He said Saudi Arabia. And I said, well, who are these insurgents in Iraq? He goes, they're mostly Saudi Arabians. And I was confused by that. And I looked it up online, and I got a little information. It said that 60-something percent of the people coming in are these insurgents are from Saudi Arabia. And the thought occurred to me, you know, when you hear the right wing or the echo chamber say, we need to fight them over there, you know, we have this relationship with the prince or the kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Well, it helps take the pressure off them from the Wahhabists by sending those terrorists, instead of looking at their government, to come over and fight our government there. We build that relationship with Saudi Arabia by protecting them, plus we sit on top of the oil in Iraq. So
yeah,
I was wondering, why don't we move to another country and draw them to another country like Afghanistan? But we need to be right next door to them.
Yeah, I think the point that I think it's Robert Pape has a new book out about, you know, it's called Dying to Win, about that when you invade a country, you will get suicide bombers. And in fact,
sure,
if you look at the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, five of the suicide bombers were actually Christians. This
right.
has nothing to do with religion. This
I
has
agree.
To do with the
right.
invasion and occupation of a country. As
right.
to the foreign fighters coming in from Saudi Arabia, the total number of foreign fighters is a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of
Got
the people
it.
In Iraq who are fighting against us. The vast majority of them are Iraqis who are saying, we want our country back. America, you know, get out. And whenever a country is occupied, you end up, in the Middle East anyway, you end up with suicide bombers. Surprise, surprise. So you want to stop the suicide bombers? Leave the country. It's real simple. Rich, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. I'm Tom Hartman. It's the radio support group of, by, and for We the People. Your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. Toll free all across the United States, TomHartman.com, the website, if you'd like to drop in and say hello. Much in the news today, we were going to have Dick Patton, the conservative with the organization. Anyhow, a conservative... Yeah, the American Family Business Institute, who's saying, you know, the old death tax, we got to do away with that. I would say, you know, there is a death tax in America. It's called old age. If you're old and you're in the middle class, the only way that you can get your medical care paid for, so you have to go into a nursing home and or hospice care or a hospital. And we're looking, and you're looking at the cost of, you know, $50,000, $80,000, $100,000, $120,000 a year. The only way that you can get Medicare to cover that, or Medicaid rather, state Medicaid programs to pay for that, is if you are in, is if you're a pauper. And so you have to wipe out your entire life savings. You can't give it to your children. If you've done that within the last 3 years, they can get it back from your children. And that's the true death tax in America, I'm telling you. That's the real disaster. But anyhow, he's not going to be with us. So, and in fact, Scott, give up on it. It's don't pursue it any further. Eric Rudolph sentenced today. One of America's homegrown terrorists. The British are all wondering, you know, how is it that we have terrorists in Great Britain? You know, what's the amazing thing there? Well, you have terrorists in Great Britain the same reason that we have terrorists here in the United States, because there are people who view in their minds who have this perception of an occupying army. It's very simple. Tim McVeigh believed that the United States was occupied by an alien force. He had been listening to too much of Ronald Reagan's rhetoric, that the government was evil, that the government was a them, that we didn't live in a democracy, that the government, Reagan says, you know, the government is not the solution, the government is the problem. And so Tim McVeigh decided to do something about it. He thought he could bring down the government in the United States. He blew up a federal building. And you've got, you know, similar situation in the UK, folks who believe that the British government is behaving oppressively. And, of course, in Iraq, you're not happy with the Iraqi government. This is fascinating. This is from the Boston Globe. New investigations by the Saudi Arabian government and an Israeli think tank, both of which painstakingly analyzed the backgrounds and motivations of hundreds of foreigners entering Iraq to fight the United States, have found that the vast majority of them were not former terrorists and became radicalized by the United States invasion of Iraq. This, you know, it's like it took the Boston Massacre to radicalize Americans, and then the battle on Boston, you know, in Lexington Green. And, the shot heard around the world to radicalize America. It's taking our invasion and occupation of Iraq to radicalize the Middle East. George W. Bush, with his stunning incompetence. George W. Bush and Don Rumsfeld, breathtaking incompetence. Dick Cheney, Condoleezza Rice. They allowed 9/11 to happen on their watch, the most horrible breach of security, national security in the history of the country. And then to make it even worse, they invaded a country that had nothing to do with it and are trying to occupy it, and they're pumping oil out of it as fast as they can. The meter's not even running. $8.5 billion missing, $200 billion spent, the wealth of our nation squandered for what? Well, domestically, it gained George Bush a little political capital, to use his phrase. Internationally, it's caused us to be a hated and reviled nation. There's nothing good for the United States in this. Nothing good at all. And as the study published in the Boston Globe today points out, And also, I believe it's Robert Pape, P-A-P-E, I think is his name, the guy who has just written this book, Dying to Win. Remarkable. He was on C-SPAN for an hour yesterday. I watched him. And in fact, we should get him on as a guest. This guy, I mean, he's got it figured out. He said, you don't have suicide bombers. He was just looking at suicide bombers. He said, you don't have suicide bombers unless you have an occupying army. Period. When people perceive their country to be occupied, then you get suicide bombers. And he goes back and he looks at it and he says, and every year, the number of suicide bombers has increased because every year, the number of American combat forces occupying countries in the Arabian Peninsula has increased. The more troops we have, the more suicide bombers you're going to have. And he says, you know, people say, oh, this is all about Islam. It's a, you know, I fell into that trap. Back after 9/11, I wrote an op-ed piece that was published in a book that Rodale Press put together called From the Ashes, A Spiritual Response to the Attacks of 9/11. Billy Graham contributed to the book. The Dalai Lama contributed a piece to the book. Pope John Paul II wrote a piece for the book. A number of folks wrote for this book. Marianne Williamson wrote a piece. I wrote a piece. And what I said in that article that I wrote for that book was that Christianity had gone through a phase. Judaism and Christianity had both gone through phases where they were essentially first century religions. They were religions from 2,000 and 3,000 and 4,000 years ago. And Judaism went through a major reformation 2,000 years ago at the end of the Second Temple period, about the, you know, essentially coinciding with the beginning of Christianity, and became a more modern religion, stopped, you know, sacrificing animals and you know, stopped the whole angry God thing in a large part, and became a religion of compassion and understanding and reaching out, and the whole idea of tikkun and whatnot. And the Christianity went through a similar transition at the time of the Enlightenment. And you know, because Christianity had its bloody period, just like, you know, with Judaism, you had Joshua going into the city of Ai and killing every living person and cutting open the bellies of dead pregnant women and killing even the dogs and putting the king's head on a pike. And Christianity went through that same thing with the Crusades. And I pointed out that Judaism and Christianity had both become modern religions and that Islam had not yet done that. I was wrong. You know, my thought was that the solution to the problem of the 9/11 bombers was that we needed to help the moderates within Islam to reform Islam. Turns out, if you look empirically at the data, if you look at the science, that that's not the case. That the people who are killing themselves are not about fundamentalist Islam. Many of them are fundamentalist Muslims. But some of them, I mean, you know, they looked at the suicide bombers in Lebanon. When Israel invaded Lebanon and the suicide bombings first began back in the 1970s, five of them were Christians. Four of them were women. This is about people resisting foreign occupation, people who feel absolutely powerless. They have no army. They have no weapons. In many cases, they don't have the popular support of the population. But in their minds, they are the oppressed. And because there's a foreign force occupying the country, they're willing to blow themselves up. This is the ultimate statement of power in their mind, is to take their lives and other people's lives with them. And he points out that, you know, when Israel got out of Lebanon and we got out of Lebanon, the suicide bombers quit. And it wasn't like all of a sudden, you know, they got put in jail or all of a sudden they got killed off. It was they just went back to being normal people. Just like after the American Revolution, when the British left here, we didn't have a bunch of terrorists running around shooting at people like the British characterized us as. It's interesting. I was browsing through an antiquarian bookstore site over the weekend on the web, and there was a book published in the United Kingdom in 1777 about the American Revolution from the British point of view. I so wanted to buy that book. I was just absolutely fascinated by it. That the British characterizing us as terrorists and as barbarians who had been influenced by the savages of the Native Americans, and that because of the influence of these savages, we had become savages ourselves, and quack, 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 quack. This is the whole point of this British book that was published in England in 1777. But it was like, you know, $3,500 or something, so I couldn't, I wasn't going to buy it. It was just like, sorry, can't afford that. But I was fascinated. There's so many old books I wish they would bring back into print. But in any case, the point is that here's this study, new investigations by the Saudi Arabian government and an Israeli think tank, both of which painstakingly analyzed the backgrounds and motivations of hundreds of foreigners entering Iraq to fight the United States. These are people who came into Iraq from outside Iraq who were captured and interrogated. Have found that the vast majority of them are not former terrorists and that they became radicalized by the war. They were just average people who at one point stood up and said, that's it. Just like in 1944, average Americans stood up and said, that's it, we're going to take our guns and we're going to go to Germany and fight Hitler. Or go to Japan and fight Tojo, because he bombed us at Pearl Harbor. See, when you feel like your country is under attack, and there's some evidence that it's true, if you believe that your country truly is under attack by a foreign power, it doesn't require a radical religion to get people aroused. There's good old-fashioned nationalism. Good old-fashioned, it's my country, it's my people, it's my family. I want to protect them. I'm going to do what I can. And you could say, I mean, this is very much part of human nature. And perhaps, I would say probably a good part of human nature. Not that the terrorist bombings are a good thing, but the instinct to protect your own is a good thing. The studies cast doubt, the Boston Globe says, on President Bush's claim that those responsible for some of the worst violence are terrorists who seized on the opportunity to make Iraq the so-called central front in a battle against the United States. No, not the case. Here you got George Bush. I mean, George Bush laying this stuff out, and he's just wrong. He's wrong. Now, is he lying to us, or does he really believe this wrong-headed stuff? He says, the terrorists will know that the outcome in Iraq will leave them emboldened or defeated. Maybe it'll just make them go away. You know, when the towers were bombed, was it Khyber Towers? I don't recall. When the U.S. barracks were bombed in Lebanon, Ronald Reagan was president. And you know, a couple hundred of our soldiers died. What did Reagan do? He pulled out of Lebanon. What happened? The suicide bombing stopped. Reagan did the right thing. Reagan did the absolute right thing. Junior can't learn from the lessons of his own mentor and protege. And now, by the way, we're going to go after Saddam Hussein for crimes he committed in 1982 when we were supplying him with weapons and he was our guy. That's going to be an interesting trial. Go figure. 20 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Turn the world into one big Texas.
Turn the world into one big Texas. Yeah, that's the plan, no doubt about it. 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number. You're in the real free speech zone. No RNC pass required. No barbed wire on the outside. Welcome back to our program, TomHartman.com. Click live chat if you want to find out the real secrets. Ellen Ratner is with us. Sorry about that, Ellen. I got distracted there for a minute. Ellen Ratner, our Washington bureau chief. Hey, Ellen.
Well, hi. Actually, today the president had his briefing with the prime minister of India. Of course, two questions per side, two questions from the U.S., two questions from the other side. And as usual in the Bush administration, the people are picked. He didn't even bother to look up today. He just read the two people that he was going to let ask questions from the list. No women, just the two guys.
Yeah, and the two guys asked what?
Well, the big question was, of course, about this Rove issue. And the issue is that that today Bush said, he said, it's being played out in the press, and I think it's best if people wait until the investigation is complete before you jump to conclusions. I will do so as well. I don't know all the facts. I want to know all the facts. The best place for the facts to be done is by somebody who's spending time investigating. I would like to end this as quickly as possible. And if somebody is committed, has somebody committed a crime, they will no work, longer work in my administration. Well, immediately the Democratic National Committee said, hey, he has changed. And actually, Victoria called me immediately from there. She texted me a message. And she said, he's now already changing the bar. Originally, he said that if anybody was leaking in his administration, they would be gone. Now they have to commit a crime because, of course, the rule for committing these kind of crimes is much less so.
Which means that they have to be convicted, and which means they have to successfully, or they have to lose their appeal, which means that maybe it'll be 3 or 4 years before we know, and by then he's no longer in office.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
George W. Bush weaseling out once again. Good old flip-floppy George.
You got it. Now, also, an interesting little factoid for you. In the month of April, the Treasury reported that foreigners bought a net of $47.8 billion in U.S. securities. Well, now, this last month, $60 billion. So if you add that up, $60 billion, you're going with $750 billion a year would be bought up foreign securities by foreigners.
Wow. Any kind of breakout of who the foreigners are?
Well, we haven't gotten a breakout. We could call the Treasury Department and see if we can find that out.
That would be fascinating to find out because, you know, China, we reported last week, China threatened us with nuclear weapons. Today, Agence France-Presse quotes a Chinese general as saying that they're not going to back. Well, here, China refused yesterday to retract statements made by one of its generals that they would use nuclear weapons against American cities if we simply targeted their weapons. They said if the Americans draw their missiles and position-guided ammunition on the target zone in China's territory, we will have to respond with nuclear weapons. If the Americans are determined to interfere, then we will be determined to respond. My statement is clear. How you interpret it is up to you, says Mr. Zhu, the Chinese foreign ministry spokesman.
I mean, this administration just is not doing its homework.
We have sold ourselves out to the Chinese and to the multinational corporations who have sold us out to the Chinese. I mean, remember during World War II.
Well, during the hearings last week on all of this, there were senators who were saying, hey, listen, American corporations will do nothing because they're afraid of getting kicked out of China. So they never do anything.
Yeah. Well, what they're doing is they're taking our jobs over there, they're taking our machines over there, they're taking our technology over there, they're taking our intellectual properties over there, and now you can't build an aircraft carrier in the United States anymore. You have to have parts from China. We can't even equip and we can't put uniforms on our troops without stuff from China. I mean, it's a grim
situation.
The rule
is that only 50% of what is made for the military has to be made in the United States.
Is that a law?
Yes, 50%. That is the law, yes.
50%. That's tragic. That's absolutely tragic. You know, at World War II, we converted all our domestic industries to wartime production and just barely squeaked by. We couldn't do it again. We're in deep trouble, Ellen, and these guys put us there. Ellen Radner, thanks so much for being
you
with us today.
You got it.
We'll talk to you tomorrow. It's 29 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
A fine idea. Yes, a fine idea. Let's get free of these neocons who are running the show. It's amazing. I'm reading a book right now about Leo Strauss and the rise of the American Reich, and where it all started, how this kind of thinking that has led to the Bushevites began. Leo Strauss thinking that, you know, we had to have a national mythos, we need to have religion as part of our as part of our political structure. And oddly, he was doing this, he was thinking this in response to Hitler's Nazi Germany, which his family had fled. And Leo Strauss, a professor at the University of Chicago, the mentor of Paul Wolfowitz and Doug Feith and Richard Perle, and indirectly Dick Cheney and Don Rumsfeld and others of the neocons. Oddly, I saw Daniel Patrick Moynihan is listed as one of these neocons, even though he was a Democrat. And they believed that you know, looking at the 60s and you know, the 60s, it's really interesting. That decade, two things happened. The first was birth control was not only decriminalized, that had happened early in the 60s in the Griswold versus the state of Connecticut lawsuit, which I think was 64, might have been 63, which struck down, the Supreme Court struck down state laws that banned birth control. But even more important, it was in the early 60s, and I forget the year now, but I think it was 61 or 62, that the first commercial birth control pill was brought to the market that was actually safe and effective and was widely available. And once the Griswold decision knocked down the state laws against birth control, this fueled the so-called sexual revolution. And then at the same time, in what was it, 65, I think it was, or 66, you had, might have been a little earlier than that, might have been 64, Richard Alpert and Timothy Leary at Harvard University experimenting with LSD. And my recollection was it was 1964 that Life magazine did a 3 or 4 page spread when the chairman of Time of Life Incorporated, or Time, I'm not sure if it was Time Life at the time, but of Life magazine, took LSD. He was an elderly man, and I'm drawing a blank on his name at the moment, and wrote about his experience in fairly glowing terms. That was still legal then. And you had, you know, Mr. Owsley making this stuff, and you know, people were passing out LSD on street corners in the mid 60s. And so you had the birth control pills and acid, and the result was there was a significant change in the culture, particularly of young people in the United States, because of their exposure to psychedelics and the availability of birth control. And it literally changed our culture. Well, people like Leo Strauss and this guy Saeed, who was down at the University of Missouri at St. Louis, both looked at this and said, "This is a culture that is going to hell. This is a culture that is disintegrating. This is a terrible, terrible thing." And then the protests started against the Vietnam War in 67, 68, 69, Summer of Love in 68 in San Francisco. And they said, this is it. This is the end of American, of Western civilization. We're seeing the descent. This is like the last days of Rome. This is Caligula. And they were determined that they had to fix it. And Saeed down in St. Louis went back to Egypt and started the Muslim Brotherhood and participated in the assassination of Anwar Sadat. And his disciple was a man by the name of Amin Zawahiri. And Zawahiri's disciple was a fellow by the name of Osama bin Laden. And thus the Muslim Brotherhood morphed into Al-Qaeda. And then at the University of Chicago, we had Leo Strauss, who instead of being Muslim, like the guy down in St. Louis, was Jewish. And he came to the conclusion that the best solution was an authoritarian government, just like Saeed had, that an authoritarian government that had strong ties to a national and relatively authoritarian religion. And that if you had that authoritarian government, authoritarian religion, and oddly, Leo Strauss thought that the best religion for America would be Christian. And both of them believed that the ends justify the means, that it's not only okay and appropriate, but even necessary to lie to people about what you're up to, because your end is so noble. Both of them believed that democracy was a dangerous thing, echoing the thoughts of John Adams back at the founding of our country, that you really can't trust what Adams referred to as the rabble, that you have to have a ruling elite. The big difference being that they thought that it should be a meritocracy, an elite of people who have demonstrated their right to be in the elite by their intellect, by their moral stance, by their commitment to their religion, as opposed to the traditional elite, the traditional European elite, which was purely hereditary. And so we have the neocons of Islam, known as Al-Qaeda, a very conservative fundamentalist organization. And you have the neocons of the United States, known as the neocons, well, known as the Bush administration right now, who are, you know, fundamentalist Christians, although there are a lot of fundamentalists, as it were, fundamentalist neocons in it, whether they're Jewish, whether they're Christian, whether they're agnostic. They still believe that it's important to promote that national religion. They still believe that it's important, you know, to merge church and state. They still believe it's important to have a ruling elite, to allow the wealthy in and control things. You know, it's a reinvention of Edmund Burke. Sir Edmund Burke, back in the 1770s, had this long debate with Thomas Paine, ironically. Thomas Paine and he were friends for a while. And after the American Revolution, Paine went up back to England and visited Sir Edmund Burke. Sir Edmund Burke was one of the Tories, one of the conservative philosophers, politician, historian. And Paine spent a week at his home. And then the French Revolution began, and Paine thought, oh, this is the coolest thing. The French are doing what the Americans did, and he headed off to France. And at that time, Thomas Paine's book, The Age of Reason, was published in England. And in The Age of Reason, Thomas Paine argues that to have religion involved in government will be the death knell of a country. It's basically a deist screed. It's not anti-Christian, but it was interpreted as such by the people of the day. And so the king tried Thomas Paine in absentia, because Paine was over in France, for treason, for libelous sedition. And convicted him, sentenced him to hanging. And in the meantime, Paine is over in France, and Robespierre, Maximilien Robespierre, the leader of the French Revolution, they're trying to decide whether or not to cut the head off of King Louis XVI and his wife. Was it the 16th? Whichever it was, whichever Louis it was, and Marie Antoinette, his wife, trying to decide whether to send him to the guillotine. And Thomas Paine gets up before the French government, the group that had organized it, so the little band of revolutionaries, and says, no, you shouldn't do this. Why don't you exile them to the United States? You know, let your revolution be nonviolent. And so what do? They throw Thomas Paine in jail, where he thinks he's going to die. And finally, he gets out and he goes back to America, and he lives in obscurity in Greenwich Village. And when he finally dies, only six people show up for his funeral. Why? Because he wrote this book that was perceived as an atheist screed. And the people in America didn't like that any more than the British did. The Age of Reason, his book, The Age of Reason. But in any case, Edmund Burke and Thomas Paine are having this argument in mail, sending letters back and forth. And Edmund Burke says to Paine, he says, it does me no harm if a person of lowly station, such as a tallow maker, that would be a candle maker, or a hairdresser, is allowed to perform their job. However, if such a man is allowed to participate in the governance of a nation, it does society great harm. In other words, there needs to be a ruling elite, and it can't be made up of the masses. The ignorant masses can't have that. That's the underpinning of even modern conservative philosophy. Sir Edmund Burke's statement to that effect and other statements similar to that are quoted by Barry Goldwater. They're quoted, you know, they're on and on the list. Russell Kirk, who wrote The Conservative Mind in 1954, the Bible of modern American conservatism, quotes Edmund Burke at length. In fact, most of the book is about Edmund Burke, Sir Edmund Burke. So, I mean, you have to understand the conservative worldview. The difference between the conservative worldview and the liberal worldview that began back in the 1700s. It really began in the late 1600s with a period of time called the Enlightenment. When you had Jean-Jacques Rousseau and John Locke, who were writing about the possibility that people could actually govern themselves, that they didn't have to have a governing elite. And, of course, the blowback from this was Sir Edmund Burke and his Tories, his conservatives, who said, no, you must have a governing elite, otherwise you're going to have anarchy. You guys are anarchists. And the liberals, then they were called liberals then. George Washington, I hope I shall ever see America be at the forefront of liberality. Thomas Jefferson, America is a liberal nation. the liberals who believed in the writings of Rousseau and John Locke. John Locke, who his second treatise on government, published in the late 1600s, said, you know, every man is born with the right to life, liberty, and the ownership of his own of his property. And Jefferson slightly changed that to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But these guys were the seminal thinkers of liberalism, and America was founded as a liberal country in reaction to the conservatism of the UK. And we've been a liberal country ever since, and you know, with the idea, and liberalism being the definition, that we can govern ourselves. And the conservatives have always been suspicious of this. They've always made the statement that, well, if you give the power to all the people, they'll simply vote themselves giant welfare checks and tax themselves to death, and the country will will disintegrate. I'm sorry, it's not how it works. That's not how it works. It has never worked that way anywhere in the world. As long as the people actually have control, there's this automatic self-correcting mechanism. Things don't work right, the people change it. But the conservatives don't trust the people. That's the fundamental thing. Whether it's the American conservatives or whether it's the Islamic Middle Eastern conservatives, they don't trust the will of the mass of the people. They feel that they have to have a ruling elite that controls the will of the people. And it's just, I think it's just so important that people get it, what this divide is and where it's coming from. 1-866-889-8894, a telephone number. Howard in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Howard, welcome to the program.
Yes, and that was very interesting listening to you there.
Well, thank you. You know, this is the stuff that back in the throughout the 19th century and the first half of the 20th century, people learned this stuff in elementary school, and I learned a lot of it in high school in the 1950s and 60s, in school in the 50s and 60s, but not all of it. But we don't teach this stuff. It's been 40-50 years since we've taught this stuff in our schools, or at least 30 years since we've taught this stuff in our schools, and I think it's a tragedy that our kids don't understand the foundation of our own country.
I never heard any of this information where I went to school at all. They kind of stayed away from politics quite a bit, so they didn't go into that area.
Yeah, interesting. Interesting.
Didn't go into that area. What I want to talk about I'll make a statement, and then you can respond to what I say.
Okay.
That kind of like a question.
All right.
I feel that. Or a question: why is it Sunoco from China?
The company in China.
Is that how you pronounce it?
The company in China that wants to buy Unocal. You're talking
about?
Yeah. Frankly, I don't have it in front of me, and I don't recall. I'm sorry.
Okay, I think it's.
It's not Sunoco like the old Sun Oil Company.
It's Sunoco or something like
yeah,
that.
Something
Chinese oil concern, which is really not a private corporation. It's owned by the damn government of China.
Well, I think 35% of it is, yeah.
Yeah, and my question would be, well, how come Unocal's not buying them? I'm saying to you...
Because Unocal doesn't have the money.
I'm saying to you...
And because the Chinese won't allow us to.
Right, that they have laws that won't allow that to happen.
That's right.
I am saying to you that there is a direct link between all the products that are on the shelves in Walmart and what's going on with the United States economy.
I absolutely agree. I'm telling you, this all began with Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan came along, and when Reagan came into office, you'll remember, if you're old enough to remember, I think, I suspect you are.
I'm in my 60s.
Okay, so you remember when Sam Walton was running Walmart, and their slogan was "Made in America." Remember that?
No, I do not remember that.
Okay, well, you must not have been. You had a Walmart near you back in the late 70s.
Up in the Northeast.
Yeah, okay. I was living in Atlanta, Georgia, and we had a Walmart down there, and the "Made in America" was their slogan, and this was in the early 1980s and the late 1970s, and Sam Walton's thing was "Made in America," and then you know Sam Walton dies, and all of a sudden it's like that's gone, and it's "Made in China," and this explosion began of stuff, and and Reagan was the one who first wanted to negotiate these trade deals, and then Herbert Walker Bush started pushing for what's called fast-track authority, which allows the president to circumnavigate Congress and negotiate trade deals, bilateral trade deals with other countries, you know, bilateral being two countries, us and somebody else, and negotiate specific trade deals to knock down tariffs, to knock down, you know, the tax, the import tax that we had on products to level the playing field. And because the way it used to work is that if it costs a dollar to make a pair of shoes here and 10 cents to make a pair of shoes in Malaysia, there would be a 90 cent import tax, a tariff. George Herbert Walker Bush, you know, fought for that. Bill Clinton made it even worse, signing NAFTA and GATT. And now here we've exported all of our industries and our jobs with them. People don't get it. They say we've exported our jobs. We actually exported our industries, and we're left defenseless and incapable of even manufacturing our own stuff. Howard, we're out of time for the segment. I appreciate your call. Thank you for calling from Pittsburgh and listening to us on WPTT there. It's Tom Hartman, 10 minutes before the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 4.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan, listening on WTKG. Hey, Rick.
Yes, great show as always, Tom.
Thank you.
I've been listening to the first hour about the Chinese situation, and I would certainly agree with you that the Bush administration is the most corrupt in American history, and I would agree that if we keep doing what we're doing with our trade policies, we'll be handing the Chinese our infrastructure. But I do think that the Chinese have always been potentially our most dangerous enemy ever since they acquired nuclear weapons. I just wondered if you remember, and I don't know whether this is an apocryphal story or not, that when Brezhnev and Nixon we're having one of their summit meetings that Brezhnev just said, maybe half jokingly, why don't we just divide the world in half? You know, we'll take half of it and you can have half. And, you know, in retrospect, that doesn't seem like a bad idea. We wouldn't have to worry probably about the Islamic threat or the Chinese threat because the Russians would have taken care of that. And, of course, if we could have just this hemisphere, we don't have too many enemies in this hemisphere either. What do you think?
Yeah, I don't remember that, Rick. I'm sorry, and I don't think it's a good idea. Is the bottom line? It just doesn't make sense to me. I'm sorry. It's a tough one. See that the assumption of that is that imperialism is a good thing. That it's a good thing for a nation to continue its existence by virtue of sucking the marrow out of the bones of another nation, and it simply never works. It just doesn't work. When nations try to occupy other nations, when they try to play the game of empire, over time, it falls apart. It didn't work for the Greeks. It didn't work for the Romans. It didn't work for the Sumerians. And it's not going to work for us. I mean, it's just not something that you can do. It's not a healthy thing. It's not a good thing for democracy. We have a caller from Grand Rapids. Hey.
Hey. It's Tomas.
Hey, Tomas. What's up? We got 30
seconds. Hey, brother. Oh, I'm on the radio now?
You are on the radio live. Yep, Scott stepped out, so I just answered the phone myself. So, what's up?
Okay, I'm loving the call-free zone, but I'm just going to throw something in there. Because when it first started, whenever it was, a year and a half ago, they said that they sent Wilson to Africa to find out if the Africans were selling uranium to Saddam.
Right.
Now, what African government is going to say, "Oh yeah, hey, how you doing there, Ambassador Wilson?"
Well, he used to work in Africa. I mean, we don't know what his contacts were, who he talked to. And the bottom line is, by the way, that he was right. When he came back, he said it ain't happening, and he was right. It wasn't happening. So I think that his intelligence actually turns out to have been pretty good. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Thanks, Tomas. Good to hear from you. Always good to hear from you. Moving toward a bright and sparkling future by returning democracy to the United States of America. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Thank you. the man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to the third hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast on the Sirius Satellite Radio System, beaming around the planet on RadioPower.org, podcasting from WhiteRoseSociety.org and Apple's iTunes. Welcome back to our program. Also on cable systems in 29 states on CRN Digital. Rush Limbaugh has attacked Ken Mellman, the head of the RNC, for going to the NAACP and apologizing for the Republican Party's strategy of divide and conquer, or bait and, I'm not sure how to attack basically the Southern strategy, picking up the old racist baton from the Southern Democrats and just handing it over to the Southern Republicans, the white Southern Republicans. In fact, Limbaugh referred to the group as the NAACP, which he says stands for the National Association for the Advancement of Liberal Colored People. Race relations in the United States, not anywhere near healed. The legacy of slavery lives on. And yet, at the same time, there has been a dramatic change for African Americans in the United States, largely since the 1950s, the rise of the middle class, out of the Brown versus Board of Education ruling and other rulings. But really, this goes all the way back. And one of the seminal points, one of the turning points, apparently, according to Larry Tye, the author of a new book, Rising from the Rails, Pullman Porters and the Making of the Black Middle Class, one of the elements in creating the black middle class apparently had something to do with George Pullman. Is that right, Larry?
It is right. It goes back to the late 1800s when George Pullman made the momentous decision to hire only blacks as porters or servants on his new sleeping cars.
That's interesting. Larry Tye, by the way, a longtime reporter for the Boston Globe, now directs a Boston-based training program for medical journalists, a former Nieman Fellow at Harvard. He's also the author of The Father of Spin and Homelands. And, Larry, is there a website for you and for this book?
There is, www.LarryTye, L-A-R-R-Y-T-Y-E, my name is one word, .com.
Okay, pretty straightforward. And why did George Pullman decide to hire only African Americans to staff his cars?
Three really simple reasons. One is he wanted people who he could pay as little as possible, and he paid these Pullman porters just little enough that they could almost make a living wage. The second is he wanted people who would work endless hours for him, and he worked them 400 hours a month. But the most important reason was he wanted these passengers, mainly middle-class passengers who were traveling across country, to feel like they got the ultimate in service. And so he hired just freed slaves to be the servants on the Pullman car. And what that meant was if you got drunk on a trip across country, they'd clean up after you. If your bed needed making, your shoes needed shining, they'd take care of it. And maybe as importantly, if on a long trip across country you ended up in the berth of somebody who wasn't your spouse on this romantic ride across America, the Pullman porters would keep their lips sealed the entire time. They had a social separation from their passengers, the white passengers, the black porters, that made it clear you'd never run into them in any embarrassing situation off the car where they might remember and recount what you had done on the car.
So what stays on a Pullman? So what happens on a Pullman car stays on a Pullman car.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Interesting. Now, in your book, you document the surprising and interesting number of people who track back to the Pullman porters. You talk about, for example, Elaine Jones ran the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. Her father, who is her role model, spent 19 years working as a Pullman porter. Tony Fulton, member of the Maryland House of Delegates, learned lessons from his father, who was a longtime chef for the B&O Railroad, and you know, on it goes. I mean, it's just
Thurgood Marshall, the first black Supreme Court justice, worked his way through college by being a train porter, was the son of a train porter. You're right. We could go
right
on.
And he argued Brown versus Board of Education before the Supreme Court when he was a lawyer, did he not?
Absolutely, he did.
Yeah. So
it was an extraordinary number when you consider that at their height there were only about 10,000 Pullman porters. And in the entire 100 years of the railroad, there were probably only 20,000 men who ever worked as a porter. And the fact that they made up such a disproportionate numbers of famous blacks, from mayors and governors to scientists and lawyers and doctors, something special was going on here, and I think that something special was that these guys, during their time on the train, picked up critical lessons from their white passengers. They were carrying the whites who ran America, and they watched the way they talked, they watched the way they dressed, and most importantly, they watched the way that education was the key to the success of most of these white passengers. The porters saved their tips, they saved their meager salaries, and they saw in extraordinary numbers their kids and grandkids go to college and go to graduate school.
Fascinating. And so you're suggesting that the black middle class in America, in large respect, to a large extent, is the result specifically of George Pullman and the Pullman porters.
I'm saying that it owes a lot to him, and I'm saying that if you're looking for the perfect all-American success story, you can't get much better than guys who started out as slaves, who went to work on the railroad, and who saw their children and grandchildren become not just the heart of the black middle class, but the heart of America's professional leaders.
Now, at the same time, George Pullman there was a dark side to the Pullman Company. There was a major strike there. Pullman was running the company sort of like the old, you know, I owe my soul to the company store sort of thing. The city, wasn't Pullman, Ohio, wasn't there a city named after him where there were workers who were making the cars?
Absolutely.
And at one point he decided to abandon that city and shut it down. It's been a couple of years since I read this. This is in Union history. And, you know, tell us that story.
You got a good memory, and the fact is that that George Pullman never did any of this because he wanted to be a benefactor for blacks. He did it because he was a cold-hearted robber baron entrepreneur of that era, and it just so happened that hiring blacks served well in terms of getting his sleeping car service on the road. But the story that you're talking about is back in 1897. The workers who worked for George Pullman and lived in his town and built his trains, these workers were making very, very little money. It was a recession back then. George Pullman raised their rents, and at the same time he did that, he lowered their income. He lowered their salaries. He put a squeeze on them. They had no choice but to go on strike. They tried.
Now, let me just interrupt here.
Sure.
The reason that Pullman did this in the late 1890s was because demand for his Pullman cars was diminishing, was it not?
Absolutely. It was a recession, and he was facing a crunch,
right.
And he decided his workers should share in his crunch.
Right. So it wasn't just Pullman all of a sudden decided that he was going to start bashing his employees. It was more like HP or IBM or GE or whatever. Right now, they say, well, you know, we're not having such a profitable quarter, so we're going to offshore our manufacturing to a cheap country, and we're going to fire a whole bunch of American employees.
Absolutely. He was neither evil nor good. He responded to the forces of the market, and the market back then, as you're saying rightfully, was constrained in terms of orders for his sleeping cars. A recession, people were riding less on these cars, and he wanted his workers to share in his pain, only he made it an untenable situation for them by cutting income and raising rents at the same time. They went on strike, and he came in and said, look, I'm not going to put up with a strike. He fired all the striking workers. They ended up bringing in the Chicago police, the state militia.
There was terrible violence,
Guard.
Was there not?
It was the most violent strike to that point in American history, and Pullman was at the center of it. And it was such, when he died, his children were so worried about how much his workers hated him that they actually covered his grave with concrete, with metal bars. It was quite an extraordinary thing. And the interesting thing is that the guy who took over for him in the Pullman Company was Abe Lincoln's son, Robert Todd Lincoln, who thought that might be a good thing to go back and do to his father's grave in the worry that someday somebody might want to rob his grave. And Robert Todd Lincoln ended up learning brilliantly from George Pullman how to be a hard-headed taskmaster in terms of running his company. The Pullman porters used to say that Abe Lincoln freed the slaves, and his son Robert Todd, when he ran the Pullman Company, re-enslaved them in chattel slavery or industrial slavery.
That's amazing. That's a piece of the puzzle that I did not know, and I thought I understood the history of that era.
Uh-huh.
That's a remark. What year was that Robert Todd Lincoln was running the company?
It was shortly after Abe Lincoln died, which was just at the turn of the century. Robert Todd Lincoln ran it from something like 1895 or 97. For about the next 15 years.
So this would have been Abraham Lincoln's grandson.
It was actually Abraham Lincoln's son, Robert Todd. Good question in terms of the age, but he was older then. This was a guy who had done a lot of things. He'd had a lot of...
Right, he was only 8 or 9 years old when his father died, wasn't he?
Exactly.
And he, but you said it was right after his father died.
I'm sorry, right after, his, right after George Pullman died.
I see. Okay. Thank you. That's what led me to my confusion.
And it was actually Robert Todd Lincoln during the years when the Pullman Porters were trying to start a union and ended up starting the first successful black trade union in American history. The guy who did the most to try to keep them from forming a union, including in bringing in strike breakers and doing all kinds of nasty things, was Robert Todd Lincoln.
That's amazing. That's absolutely amazing. Larry Tai, what's the lesson for today from your book, Rising from the Rails?
The lesson is that never to judge people by their outward appearance. The Pullman Porters seemed like the most servile of workers in America. Anybody who remembers riding a Pullman train remembers getting great service, but always remembers these often elderly gentlemen who looked like they were the ultimate in servility. In fact, these guys were eating a lot of the abuse they took in order to see their kids and grandkids rise. And I think that the Pullman Porters gave birth not just to the first black trade union, but helped give birth to the civil rights movement in America. And we got to understand our history, and for African Americans who are looking for great, noble stories of their past in America, they can't do any better than the Pullman Porters.
I'm curious, we just have about a minute and a half left here, Larry, how you as a white guy came to write this story about chronicling black history in America.
Good question. I was doing something wonderful that they allow journalists every year, to 24 of them from around the world, to come and spend a year at Harvard as a Nieman Fellow. I had a professor at Harvard who was even whiter than I am, who was intrigued by the Porters as this all-American success story. He gave me the bug, and several years after that, I was so obsessed with, you're always looking for the perfect little story as a journalist, like you are always looking for, perfect little story to tell the bigger story. To me, the Porters told the story of black America and of America.
Yeah, it is. It's a brilliant book. The photos in it are fascinating. The book itself is well written. It's easy to read, and just a remarkable book. Remarkable read. I recommend it to our listeners. Larry Tai, the website, www.larrytai.com, right?
Absolutely. And thank you very much, Tom.
You're welcome. The book, Rising from the Rails, Pullman Porters and the Making of the Black Middle Class. It's well worth the read. And Larry, thanks for being with us today. Much appreciated. And we go from that to Rush Limbaugh saying that Ken Melman, the head of the RNC, the guy who runs the, you know, man wanted for anonymous sex ads on the gay websites, Ken Melman, who yesterday went before the NAACP and apologized for the Republicans' strategy of attack and, you know, of the so-called Southern strategy. Is, you know, he said, Ken Melman said, some Republicans gave up on winning the African-American vote, looking the other way or trying to benefit politically from racial polarization. I am here today as the Republican chairman to tell you we were wrong. Ken Melman saying that. And then Limbaugh coming out saying Limbaugh accused Republicans of planning to go bend over and grab the ankles. Isn't this pathetic? Isn't this pathetic? It's tragic. 20 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. We'll be back with your calls after this.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
So, hey, there's a new American way. No one serving those deserving, but there's less tax to pay. We abuse our might and mock the world as we say. Don't mess with the U.S. of A. Don't mess with the U.S.
Don't you dare. We want our Hummers and our oil.
Did you watch the Sunshine State? How the scales got tipped to seal Al's fate? Jeb Bush winked, I told you so. And the butterfly flew into Palm Beach. Both Al and Joe got one punch each. 10,000 Gore votes were cast aside before you know.
And welcome back, my friends. Yeah, well, it's about the election before the last, but still happening. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number if you'd like to call in. Paul in Santa Fe on the line. Hey, Paul, welcome to the Tom Hartman program. Thanks for calling.
Tom,
Did you hear what Bush said this morning about the Valerie Plame investigation?
Yeah, he's changed his criteria. It used to be that if somebody in his administration leaked classified information, they would be fired. Now it's if they are convicted before a jury after lengthy legal proceedings, he will consider firing them.
Yeah, so conceivably we could have Karl Rove, Scooter Libby being indicted and still being in the administration serving.
Well, and they could even be convicted in a trial, which of course would take a year or two, and then appeal. And on an appeal, they're still, you know, the conviction is set aside until the appeal is finished. I guess, and I'm not a, you know, if I, the details of exactly how this would spin in public relations are something that, you know, time will tell. You know, he could say, well, it's on appeal, you know, and, you know, my guess is he's going to figure out a way to keep Rove on until he leaves because you got, you know, he has this fundamental problem. You know, if Carl, yeah, I saw that. That's great. It's if Carl, Heidi just showed me this photograph of Karl Rove being dragged off by a couple of cops. It's, actually, there's that photograph is on our KPOJ blog. If you go to tomhartman.com and you can see it. They've got this fundamental problem that if Karl Rove is drinking a glass of water, George Bush can't speak. So, you know, it's an issue. Paul, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. George in Coos Bay, Oregon on the line. Hey, George, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I had a saying or an expression that I thought might be clever for the neocons. Call them the Bolsheviks.
Yeah.
But other than that, I wanted to mention, to remind everybody that when Bush was real early in his administration in 2001, he went on a few talk shows, and they asked him what would happen if China attacked Taiwan, and he said, I would do anything it takes, including military. And I was shocked.
He's not saying that anymore.
I was appalled at that provocative stance.
Yeah, well, he was playing bully boy. I mean, it's we all know that George will say and do just about anything to get elected, but when it comes to actually governing, he's a divider, not a uniter. I mean, it works the other way around. The exact opposite is what happens. It's the ultimate in flip-flops. George, thanks for the call.
Thank you. Love you. Love your songbook.
Thank you.
Bye for now.
Thank you. Appreciate it. 1-866-889-8894. Ray in Pittsburgh listening on WPTT. And George, thanks for listening on KBBR there in Goose Bay. What's up, Ray?
Hi, Tom. This is Pittsburgh. Have you ever heard of Morgan Reynolds? He was on one of the local programs here a few weeks ago in Pittsburgh, and he's a professor emeritus, is it, at Texas A&M University. He has a PhD.
Yeah.
And he was chief economic advisor in the Labor Department for Bush's first term.
Okay.
And he was questioning the he said he just got to thinking about this, about the Title I and II,
mm-hmm.
how they came from the top down
right.
instead
yeah.
of from the bottom up.
Yeah, it looked like a controlled implosion.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he's
saying building demolition.
He was saying he's saying it's an inside job, but he
well,
said,
he's not alone in that. There are a lot of people saying that. I haven't gone over to that side, but I'm keeping my ears and eyes open.
I thought maybe you could interview him so more people could hear him.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Thanks for the heads up, Morgan Reynolds. Thanks,
okay.
Ray. I appreciate
uh-huh.
it. It's fascinating. I mean, what I find particularly interesting is the broad swath of people who are convinced that the Bush administration was somehow in on 9/11. You know, as I said, I'm not convinced of that, but I'm not also certain that that's not the case. We'll see. 29 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. I like guacamole and picante, Bonnie. So, you know, what can you say? Speaking to the chat room here. It is so cool. There are folks, you know, just hanging out and having a conversation and occasionally sharing things that you don't hear on the radio. What can I say? That you don't hear on the radio. Some of the finest minds in the entire web. Just go to tomhartman.com and click live chat, and it'll drop you right in there. Very simple, very straightforward. Anyhow, welcome back to our program. 1-866-889-8894, our toll-free telephone number, TomHartman.com, our website, our program, The Pill That Will Help You Escape the Matrix. Are you going to take the red pill or the blue pill? Now, you know, digressing somewhat from the movie, I would recommend the blue pill. As in the Democratic pill. I got an email here from Sheldon. He says, this is from a colleague of mine. It also appears on Brad's blog. He says, I was personally affected because about six emails from my friend in which he refers to Downing Street after downingstreet.org didn't make it through. We were both puzzled until this surfaced. Here's what happened. David Swanson, who's been a guest on this program many, many, many times. David is a good friend of ours and a good friend of our program. And runs or started or co-started or whatever. He's strongly affiliated with AfterDowningStreet.org, which is a marvelous website that I strongly recommend you check out right this minute even. AfterDowningStreet.org. And David was doing email blasts to people who are subscribers to the website, you know, just, you know, updates, what's going on. And they were having petition drives and they were trying to get people to let newspapers know about it. And it was really baffling him how many, many people were not receiving the emails. Couldn't figure out why. Eventually, they put two and two together and figured out that it was only their Comcast member. Well, not just only their Comcast, but this was the most conspicuous chunk. That anybody who was using Comcast as their internet service provider was not receiving David Swanson's emails. And so he tried, you know, he called them up and they gave him the runaround. And it turned out, to make a long story short, Comcast is using a software program to filter spam that is produced by Symantec. You know, Symantec, the company that makes Norton antivirus. And so, you know, I'm wondering if everybody who has, you know, any of the Norton firewall programs is encountering the same program. I don't know. What we know for sure is that it was hitting Comcast. And apparently what had happened was somebody had figured out a way, whether this was an inside job at Symantec or whether this was the result of a number of complaints or somebody got on a list, but somebody figured out a way to get AfterDowningStreet.org, that phrase, registered with Symantec as a phrase that you will see in spam, you know, like as if it was an obscene word, or if it said, you know, enlarge your whatever, you know, it's something like, you know, breast enlargement here, or that kind of stuff. There are certain phrases that the software looks for, and if it sees those phrases, it kills the message. It deletes the message or it dumps it into a spam folder. And this Symantec software had been programmed that any email that came through that had the phrase www.afterdowningstreet.org in it, which is how David signs his emails, you know, be David Swanson, and then his URL, www.afterdowningstreet.org. Any email that he sent out that went through this Symantec filter, which, as I said, Comcast was using, would get shuttled off to the spam folder, and people never got around to reading them. And so after much hoop-de-doop and you know, going through, you know, phone calls and emails and the threats and pleading and everything else, finally they got this thing fixed. Finally they figured out that it was Symantec and got through to the Symantec people, and in one day they solved the problem. But the question that sticks in my mind is, you know, are we looking at some kind of a Brave New World scenario here? Is it possible that, you know, I have to hope that Symantec is taking steps to stop this, to prevent this from happening. Is it possible that if somebody doesn't like TomHartman.com, if somebody doesn't like Downing Street Memo, if somebody doesn't like Newsmax, you know, the right-wing website, or, you know, whatever, if somebody doesn't like some right-winger, or left-wing, or any, you know, political speech, is there some kind of backdoor, trapdoor, method, technique, whatever, that they can use to get Symantec to automatically filter these things out? And if so, then how much of our email are we missing right now? And if so, was it just some random hacker who did this? Was it the RNC who did this? Was it Ken Melman? I mean, Ken Melman obviously has some facility with the Internet. He posts, you know, guy wanted for casual sex ads on gay websites. So, you know, he knows his way around the Internet. Was it, you know, who was it? What happened? How did this get done? Inquiring minds want to know. So, you know, I find it fascinating that David's emails were not getting through because they said after DowningStreet.org, they were not getting through Comcast, they were not getting through the semantic software filter. What is it called? Bright Word or something like that. But the thing that I found, and in fact they said, the semantic folks said that they had received 46,000 complaints. Now, first of all, David has not ever spammed anybody. And secondly, the people that he does send email to are people who requested it. And third, he doesn't even have 46,000 people on his mailing list, so it's not possible that he could have sent 46,000 pieces of spam. So, you know, how does this happen? Well, there's another way that it sometimes happens. I know that this had happened to me, you know, a year or so ago. Some spammers will, I mean, people who are actually spammers will just take random websites and use them as the from URLs to send out spam. And then the spam catching software notices, hey, there's 100 million, you know, there's 10 million emails floating around that all seem to have come from this particular website, you know, joeblow@aol.com or whatever. And so all of a sudden, you know, your name or your website is on a URL, or your internet service provider is on a spam filter. It's a little problematic. So, in question, you know, how did this happen? How is this being, you know, this whole thing being exploited? What can be done about it? Is this something that we need to worry about or not? And, you know, and I have to say, I think that there's a good chance that it is something that we need to worry about and something that we should be concerned about and pay attention to. Texas. John Corberuvius wrote a marvelous piece for Mother Jones about the legacy of George W. Bush. I have said many times on this program that George W. Bush's legacy is, first of all, he trashed Texas. Texas has become one of the most heavily polluted states in the Union because George W. Bush changed the laws in Texas so that polluting industries, particularly the oil industry and the chemical industry, no longer had to go along with state guidelines, but instead they could voluntarily comply. And, you know, I mean, Bush is one of these true believers who, you know, he's one of these folks who's drank the Kool-Aid and actually believes that if you just turn governance of the commons over to the corporations, to big corporations, then you got no problem. Everything's fine. The marketplace will solve all problems. This is his belief. And, of course, it's not true. Marketplace does a lot of good things. The marketplace does solve some problems. The marketplace, you know, is a good place for competition to play out. But there is no such thing, ultimately, as a free marketplace. Because, you know, we have currency that defines marketplace. There's size of businesses that define marketplace. In a pure laissez-faire capitalism world, in a pure and free marketplace, you're going to end up with one company. Yeah, they're going to buy everybody else. I mean, anybody who's ever played Monopoly knows what I'm talking about. It's all about Monopoly. So you have to restrain Monopoly. In fact, the game of Monopoly came out in the 1920s as a way of teaching people about the dangers of Monopoly, and so many people were playing it and understanding it, it led to the anti-Monopoly laws of the 1930s. In any case, the legacy of George W. Bush here is a tragic one, a disastrous one. Texas is the breeding ground for builder-friendly legislation, writes John Corberuvius. Texas is a breeding ground for builder-friendly legislation that's being used as a model across the United States. Because of this, buying the American dream in any state could easily turn into a nightmare. These laws are called right-to-repair laws. This is like, you know, it's like right-to-work laws. The right-to-work laws say you have a right not to have a union job. You have a right to be screwed by your employer. Well, the right-to-repair laws, this is honest to God, what these cons are calling them. Right-to-repair laws. These right-to-repair laws, which govern new home construction, now say that you can no longer sue a developer who gives you a lousy house. Instead, you have to go through a privatized kangaroo court system, a form of arbitration. It's conducted in secret with no public record, and the arbitrators, who often have ties to the home building industry, are not required to follow the law in rendering their decision. So if you buy a lemon, you have a right to repair it. And I am not making this up. This is these developments, which have their origins in the tort reform agenda pushed through by Governor George W. Bush in Texas in the mid-1990s, have since spread to many other states. In the mid-90s, home builders began hiding mandatory binding arbitration clauses in new home contracts, stripping consumers of their rights to a civil trial guaranteed by the Seventh Amendment of the Constitution. Almost every builder in every state, with the exception of California, has a hidden mandatory arbitration clause that cannot be declined, removed, or negotiated. So if you are buying a new home or you are having a new home built for you, look out. George W. Bush has a gift for you. You cannot sue if you buy a lemon. Sorry. Welcome to Bush World. Ain't it wonder? Ain't it marvelous? Well, lots going on in the news. The seems that the mail spam email stuff has generated some interest here as well. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Mike in Washington, D.C. on the line. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. Partially what you were talking about with the problems with Comcast, since I'm here and I'm on Comcast,
mm-hmm.
and I have had problems. I've had problems logging on to certain sites for a while,
uh-huh.
like after Downing Street memo.
Oh, really? You couldn't even get onto the website?
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
I mean, it went away, but it was, you know, and it was, you know, I could get to other sites. I could get to Yahoo. I could get to other sites.
Well, there are these things called switches, and they are programmable. I remember about 10 years ago, I used to sysop a bunch of forums on CompuServe, and mm-hmm. the Desktop Publishing Forum, and the International Trade Forum, and the Attention Deficit Disorder Forum, and a bunch of these things. And AOL, and so I was like, you know, kind of on inside the company, as it were. And AOL had figured out, which owned CompuServe, had figured out that they could program the switches. And so what they could do was they could set it up, and there was a debate inside the company about whether or not to do this. They ultimately decided, as best I know, not to do it. But they can set it up so that if you went to a website that was within the AOL family of companies, companies that advertised with them or supported them, that you would go through instantly. And if you went to a website that was outside the AOL domain or outside the AOL website of family of companies, they would introduce a 2 or 3 second delay. So it would seem, you could program the delay. You could make it a 2 second delay, a 5 second delay, a 20 second delay. And so it would seem like certain sites just flew by, and people would want to hang out at those sites. And other sites it would take longer to get to. Now, to the best of my knowledge, they never did that. You know, but there was a discussion about it, and in fact, it became public, the fact that this discussion was being had. And companies have the ability to do this. They can slow you down going to certain websites. ISPs have that ability. And you're suggesting that actually happened to you. That's interesting.
In a related matter, a friend of mine and I were over here on the weekend talking, watching something about Nazi Germany. And I kind of shocked him. I said, once this regime collapses, which it will, I really strongly believe that we should try and decertify the Republican Party, because the Republican Party has been involved in a lot of this chicanery in
yeah.
Florida, in Ohio,
yeah.
in many other states. The party itself has been complicit. We've got Mehlman running around as a mouthpiece for the administration. And, you know, they're saying, well, we can't control what they're saying. Well, of course you can.
Yeah, you
it's
can.
The party.
You know, you're absolutely right, Mike, and it's a good point. In fact, the Republican Party is starting to behave like organized crime, and I think the RICO acts could be used against many of the folks in the Republican Party and some of the actions that they've been doing, because they have been involved in organized crime and racketeering, in my opinion. Amy in San Diego, California. Hey, Amy, what's up? We have about a minute left.
Oh, hey, Tom. I'm at work while I listened to you, and so I didn't get to hear all the details. Now, what companies are blocking these emails?
Well, it's no longer blocked, but it was somehow somebody figured out a way to get Symantec, the company that makes the anti-spam software.
Oh, okay.
They also make Norton Antivirus, but they also make a commercial product that ISPs use, and Comcast uses this product from Symantec to filter viruses and spam if you use their spam filter, if they're your ISP.
Okay.
They figured out a way to get Symantec to list afterdowningstreet.org as a phrase that would cause an email that contained it to automatically get dumped into a spam folder.
Okay, I gotcha. All right, thanks, Tom.
Sure, you're
okay,
welcome. Thanks
bye.
For the call, Amy. And you know, the question in my mind, you know, it's being portrayed in the media, and in fact, CommonDreams.org carried the story, and it's on afterdowningstreet.org. You can read David Swanson's article about it, that you know, it was somehow like, you know, Comcast doing something nasty. I don't think they did. I think that somebody exploited a essentially security loophole at Symantec, which raises, in my mind, frankly, a much larger question, which is how did this happen? And how can we prevent it from happening? And I hope that at Symantec and at Comcast, they're asking that question. I hope that David Swanson's op-ed piece is raising enough noise out there that these kinds of questions are being asked. It's the Tom Hartman Program, brought to you by Small Dog Electronics. High technology for low prices. 1-800-511-MAX. M-A-C-A.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Like a bird on a wire, like a drunk in a midnight choir, I have tried in my way to be free.
And welcome back, my friends. 4.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. In a conversation that same day, this was July 1st, 2003, according to the Washington Post, Karl Rove told Time Magazine's Matthew Cooper that Wilson's wife was in the CIA and authorized the mission to Niger. A day later, now keep in mind, this is a two-year-old conversation, July 11, 2003. A day later, Cheney's top aide, Lewis Scooter Libby, told Cooper that he heard the same thing about Plame. So Rove and Libby are talking. Rove works for Bush. Libby works for Cheney. Could it be that this originated with Bush and Cheney? Could he also have been Judith Miller's source? This is from the Think Progress blog. While media coverage in recent days, again, this is the Washington Post, has focused on conversations White House senior advisor Karl Rove had with reporters, two sources say Miller spoke with Vice President Libby's Cheney's chief of staff, Lewis Scooter Libby, during the key period in July 2003. The two sources, one who is familiar with Libby's version of events and the other with Miller's, said the previously undisclosed conversation occurred a few days before Plame's name appeared in Robert Novak's syndicated column on July 14, 2003. So then, on October 10th, 2003, we go back now in the Wayback Machine, a year and a half. Question, Scotty McClellan, earlier this week you told us that neither Karl Rove, Elliot Abrams, nor Lewis Libby disclosed any classified information. I wonder if you could tell us more specifically whether any of them told any reporter that Valerie Plame worked for the CIA. Mr. McClellan, those individuals, I spoke with those individuals, as I pointed out, and those individuals assured me they were not involved in this, and that's where it stands. End of quote. And now George Bush saying, no, he won't. He will keep on members of his staff who leak intelligence information. They have to be convicted of a crime before he'll fire them. So we're now to the ethical standards of the Reagan administration, where more members, more senior administration officials were convicted of felonies than any administration in the history of the country. And only when they were convicted of felonies did they get fired. I'm telling you, this is the most corrupt administration in the history of the United States. And you're going to see more and more and more of it as this comes out. Yeah, thanks for being with us today. Thanks to Scott for engineering our program, to Louise for producing it. We'll see you tomorrow, same time, same place. Have a great afternoon.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.